is the first day of a new era for the Supreme Court of the State of Colorado and the judiciary. And all the lawyers, of course, have their important issues to argue, but you'll have the honor of having the oral argument in our first case. So we appreciate all those in attendance, and we'll start with our first case, which is Weinstein et al. Versus Colborne LLC, case number 2010-SC-143. Are both parties ready? A couple of housekeeping matters. Argument is set for an hour, so the petitioners will have to keep track of your time. A half an hour aside. Please state your name and who you represent when you start your argument. And some of us have iPads. I want you to know that's how we keep our briefs and our notes, and we're not in any way surfing, sending emails. So just to let you know that. Let's proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, my name is Heidi Potter. With me at council table is my partner, Giovanni Rusciti, and also our associate, Jack Storti. We represent the petitioners, whom I will refer to this morning as the Weinstein parties. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if time allows. We're here today to ask the court to affirm the trial court's dismissal of the two causes of action that were alleged here for failure to state a claim and lack of standing. The trial court dismissed both of Colborne's claims. These claims involve different actions and different parties, so I will address them separately. But both of these claims fail for the same two reasons. First, they're both prohibited by the plain language of the LLC Act. In short, a limited liability company is not a corporation or vice versa. The language of the Act matters. Second, even if the court were to find that these causes of action could be stated against the members and managers of an LLC, Colborne's complaint fails to allege sufficient facts to maintain those claims. Only extraordinary circumstances allow the court to disregard the corporate entity and impose personal liability on the owners and managers of the business. Those circumstances are not present here. The first question you're asked to decide this morning is whether Section 606 of the Act provides creditors of an LLC with a derivative action against the members of the LLC. In order to answer that question, you must harmonize and interpret a number of provisions of the LLC Act. To start with, Section 606, the action pursuant to which the claim was brought, gives the right to the LLC itself a cause of action against the members of the LLC in the event of an unlawful distribution. That right, by its express terms, is not given to the creditors of the corporation.
Well, isn't that the usual circumstance with corporate law, which has the overall aim of shielding, well, in most cases, investors, but shareholders?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The purpose of the corporate veil, of the corporate fiction, is to protect those people that stand behind the corporation and to encourage investors, to encourage people to engage in business without fear of their personal assets being perpetually in jeopardy. And so that's why
you... And normally the officers of a corporation are not liable in their personal capacity.
That's exactly right. And in fact, under the LLC Act, it specifically states that members are not liable for the debts of the corporation. Again, reinforcing that rule and making it statute, making it something that has to be enforced.
Well, why is it any different in terms of the statutory policy in this prior for corporations and LLC? If directors are liable when the corporation becomes insolvent, for preferential treatment, to themselves. Why wouldn't that be true with the corporation, with LLC? I'm sorry.
So I think you're addressing two issues here. One is that the members of an LLC and whether there's a duty owed under Section 606, which is one type of claim. Another type of claim, and I think this is the claim that you're alluding to, is an action against the managers of a of an LLC, and whether or not a limited fiduciary duty under the common law applies. But to get to that point, under either of those scenarios, these two types of entities truly are different. And there's important hallmarks of LLCs that make them distinguishable from corporations. Most notably, the LLC Act gives business owners an incredible flexibility in terms of determining how the business will be managed and who will constitute the members. It isn't simply shareholders and directors whose duties and obligations are largely dictated by statute. The LLC Act allows members and managers you wouldn't have to have managers, for example. You can have just members. You can have a member-managed LLC. You can have a manager-managed LLC. You can specifically call out what the duties of a manager would be. Well, and those duties would vary.
I don't mean to interrupt you. I think it's important, and you point this out in your brief, to discuss the difference between the statutory difference between a corporation and LLC. But from a statutory policy perspective, 606 provides that it's illegal for certain things to happen in an LLC. And we also have the common law duties for corporations. So I want to know what's the reason for giving greater protection for persons who organize and participate in LLC as opposed to just the regular corporation? What's the rationale here?
Well, I think you have to think of the two acts as giving a separate bundle of rights, a separate bundle of liabilities. So the legislature can make the determination that managers or members are going to have certain liabilities or they're not going to have certain liabilities. So that's part of this issue. The second issue is there really is no common law that's applicable to LLCs yet, that you would be creating that if you impose these rules. The common law is applicable to corporations, and it grows out of what corporations do and how corporations act.
But this is really a type of corporation, is it not? I mean,
well, I think that there are similarities. There is that corporate veil exists, but they aren't identical. There really are differences, and they are as different as the acts that govern them.
What's the evidence that the General Assembly intended to totally occupy the common law with respect to this LLC Act?
Well, I think that there are a couple of provisions. First of all, Section 107, and this applies to members, for instance. It states that members, when you're going to seek personal liability of a member for an unlawful act of the company, that you would apply the piercing the veil common law, that would be appropriate. But they limited it to that. Second of all, in 2004, the legislature amended Section 109. They added Section 109. Section 109 states that the general rule that statutes in derogation of the common law are to be strictly construed is not to apply to LLCs. That to me says that we are to interpret these provisions in the LLC Act in a way that broadly gives effect to the legislature despite the common law. So I think both of those show, one, they establish a difference between corporations and LLCs, but they also show the intent of the legislature to prescribe the remedies available and to delineate these causes of action and when they can occur. So we've talked about Section 606, Section 107, Section 109. Also wanted to note that Section 713 of the Act expressly confers standing on the members of an LLC to bring derivative actions on behalf of the LLC, does not provide for other entities or persons to bring those acts that's lodged in the members. And again, we talked about Section 705. It specifically and explicitly provides that members are not personally liable for the LLC's debts.
Again, however, what is the legislative policy difference between an LLC and type of corporations we're used to dealing with?
I think there were two things that they were trying to accomplish when they created the LLC Act. One was to give the corporate protection while allowing for different tax treatment. That was one of the big things when this started, but also to give entrepreneurs and business owners much more flexibility in the way that they were going to manage and the way that they were going to constitute their membership. That is really different from the corporate context, and it allows a freedom of contract specifically and creates, in effect, a contractual entity as opposed to a statutory entity. That flexibility gives you the opportunity, for instance, to have equity and non-equity members, to have voting members and non-voting members, to really organize that structure in a way that best suits your business. So that, I think, was also at the heart of creating these types of organizations. And that's truly different than what you have under the Corporations Act.
And I guess if I could pick up on that point, I'm struggling a little bit to understand why that statutory flexibility in the context of LLCs then translates to your argument that they're entitled to greater protection.
Well, first of all, I don't know that they're entitled to greater protection. I think they're entitled to the protection that the legislature has given them and that you determine they have. How does the common law come alongside this? There is going to be interplay there, but there is no common law yet as to LLCs.
And I guess, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but just to go back to the Chief's original question, this court has interpreted the Corporation Act to expansively allow creditors to sue, and I guess his question is, why wouldn't we take that same principle and apply it to the LLC context? And I'm trying to understand your argument about the flexibility of the LLC structure and why that makes the LLC therefore different, and that we wouldn't want to import that same principle into the LLC context.
So, for instance, in the LLC context, you could say that a manager has fiduciary duties, and you could list those in your operating agreement, or you could say they have no fiduciary duties. You have that kind of flexible contractual principle to state what the manager or what the member, what those duties are that are owed. And how can you then fashion a one-size-fits-all rule that says in all instances that a member has to have these duties when, in fact, the legislature has allowed those entities to determine what those duties are going to be in the first instance, which is quite different from the context in the Corporations Act, where you have the duties of shareholders and the duties of directors largely circumscribed by statute.
Thank you.
Ms. Parker, could I ask you to, I just don't quite understand your second argument. I don't get it exactly. You say that Sheffield, that the Court of Appeals opinion relied improperly on Sheffield to reach a common law duty for the managers. And I don't understand how you get there. Could you just explain that?
Sure. So in the context that we've started discussing, we were talking about actions against members under Section 606. You're talking about actions against managers under the common law and whether there should be a limited common law duty, a fiduciary duty or whatever duty you want to call that.
A limited fiduciary duty under Anstey.
Whether or not that should apply to managers.
That's right.
And I think you have to look at a couple of things. One is, and the argument that we're making here, is that when in the corporate context, you say that this limited duty arises in the directors of a corporation, there's been some determination there that the duties either that are set forth in the statute don't adequately protect the creditor and that there needs to be this common law equitable rule and that it's not sufficient. Well, when you're talking about an LLC, the members of an LLC, excuse me, the managers of an LLC, their duties aren't expressly set forth in the statute. There are some limited duties set forth in the statute. For example, I think this touches right on that Anstein and Sheffield rule. There is a duty to act as a trustee at the insolvency of a corporation when it's being dissolved and wound up. That duty exists, and that's the duty that they're talking about in Anstein. They said in that instance, then, that you have a duty as a trustee holding the corporate property. You have that duty both to creditors now and to your corporation. But here, in the context of the LLC, one, under Section 404 of the Act, it states that that trustee duty that occurs at the winding up and dissolution, it is to the company, it's to the LLC. It doesn't provide that that duty is given to the creditors in any manner. The second piece of that is that you might also have contractual duties as set forth in the operating agreement, which are less than or more than what a director has in the corporate context. And so you can't just state.
It's troubling, though, because that really sets up the situation that in every case, you know, sensing an impending bankruptcy, that everything would be distributed to a closely held group and nothing left for the creditors.
I think could
that possibly have been the legislative intent?
I don't believe that was the legislative intent. And I think what you're really getting at here is a concern about whether or not creditors have a remedy in the event of insolvency. And creditors do have a remedy. They have a number of remedies that protect against this very issue that obviate the need for a common law remedy. For example, under the statute itself, under the LLC Act, Section 810, a creditor can move to dissolve an insolvent corporation, which would trigger then the duties of winding up the corporation and paying off creditors and liquidating assets. They can protect themselves that way. They're also protected under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. That act you can bring claims against both transferees and transferors. It would protect the creditors' rights, and that occurs both before insolvency and after insolvency, so they are protected. In addition, you can have claims brought under the piercing of the corporate veil. If a member is using the corporate fiction to defeat a legitimate claim, then you can state an action for that. It's not as if the creditors don't have remedies. Furthermore, the statute, the legislature has the ability to decide who bears that risk in a particular circumstance. I think the argument can be made in the LLC context that they've determined that that risk is in part borne by the creditor. And I think it's important to remember that creditors have an ability to protect themselves. And in fact, they can protect themselves even more in a LLC context than they can in the corporate context. It goes to this flexibility of
how do they do that?
How do they do that? For example, you could, because the operating agreement and the way that's set up so is so flexible, and in fact there is a specific statement in the LLC Act that talks about maximizing the contractual abilities of these companies, a creditor, for example, could insist that at the front end of the deal, that they would be made an assignee, for example, of a member's interest in the event of a distribution or in the event of dissolution. They could also seek personal guarantees.
Can I interrupt you for a second? The argument you're making is a little different than the one you presented in the briefs that you're making verbally, which is fine. Do you think that Sheffield has decided, the Court of Appeals case has decided incorrectly?
I do think that Sheffield is ultimately decided incorrectly.
In your opinion, if we find in your favor in this matter, we have to overrule that?
I think you do have to overrule Sheffield, because Sheffield, on this particular issue that we've been talking about, it found that the rule stated in Anstein which was in the corporation's context, is to be made applicable in the LLC context. Mm-hmm. And so you have to address that question. Another important issue here is that since you decided Anstein, the legislator, or as you were actually deciding.
Well, no, that's not. Anstein was decided after. Legislature passed that, and footnote 9 is very specific about that.
And you, and in the note, you noted that the legislature had amended a provision. They have added a provision to state that there is no fiduciary duty owed by two creditors, by directors. And so, you know, whether Anstein is even good law is still in question.
Well, I'm not sure we have to reach that question. The real issue is what to do about LLCs. So tell me where. Why is Sheffield wrong? For the reasons you've just given us verbally?
Yes, for the reasons that I've just said.
And the biggest reason, maybe I don't understand this, you better explain it to me, is that I heard you say for the first time, is that there's enormous flexibility in the contractual duties of a manager, and I suppose as a member as well, right, under the LLC.
That's correct.
And therefore, it's very difficult to attach a strict rule, or unless there's a statutory rule. Is that your point?
That is our point. And we did argue in our brief that there is this flexibility. We argued it primarily as to the 606 argument, and then I believe that we referenced it again.
Well, give me an example of what you're talking about. Why it should apply because of the contractual arrangement that would exist that is not present with a director. Give me an actual physical, you know, give me a description here, so I can understand it.
For instance, let's say that there's an LLC. They determine that a manager is going to have certain duties beyond the statute. Let's do it this way. In fact, in some states, you can do this because they state that in their LLC. You could state that they have no fiduciary duties to the company. So you could create an operating agreement that states that a manager has no fiduciary duties.
Well, wait a second. That would assume that the common law duty didn't, you know, that you could by contract overrule a common law duty. So give me an example of something how that you say the flexibility is would give us, give this particular form of doing business a contrary duty. Therefore, that we would have to conclude that there should not be a fiduciary duty when the LLC becomes insolvent.
You could say that the manager owes a duty to creditors, mm-hmm. in which case you wouldn't need common law to put that on a manager. You could say that they have certain duties in certain instances, that when a company becomes insolvent, we don't want you as the manager to be preferring a creditor over us. We want you to have your sole and exclusive loyalty and duty owed to us. So they can alter those duties, those rights, those liabilities. And that's different than it is in the corporate context.
Well, you make an argument that Colorado is one of the leading business states, and we need to come out in your direction to continue to be in that position. Is that really something we should take into effect? And if so, how has the legislature expressed its intent in that regard?
I think that it is something that you need to take into consideration. The public policy is very important here. If Colorado is now perceived as a result of a ruling in this case to offer less protection for owners, then owners are going to be less likely to want to do business here, less likely to want to start their businesses here, more likely to go to a state, you know, Delaware, for example, where they're going to get higher protection and that corporate veil is going to be harder to pierce. I think that's a very real risk of a ruling here that you can get to LLCs in this manner. And again, going back to this concept that you have a certain bundle of rights that you get to pick if you want to be governed by, if you want to be an LLC, or you have a certain different bundle of rights and liabilities if you want to pick to be a corporation, this may be one of those very reasons why people have been picking to be LLCs, because it's perceived to be more protective of owners. And for that reason,
But then that argument leads to less incentive for investors and financiers to put up the capital to make the business work. So I'm not quite seeing the balance in the argument.
I think that if owners perceive that if they're going to put money in to corporations and want to start a business here, if they perceive that they're more likely to be sued here personally and that their own individual assets are going to be lost from taking a risk of starting a business, they're going to want to start that business somewhere else where they feel more confident that their own personal assets aren't going to be exposed to liability. And for that reason, I think that if you decide that there's less protection, effectively giving additional causes of action to go against the individual and define personal liability, they're not going to want to incorporate here. They're not going to want to form an LLC here. Go to another state where you have more protection.
Well, one of the things that occurs to me, and you cited the Delaware Code, that's the statute. And it's pretty specific about what the rights are, right?
The Delaware Code applicable to corporations or the Delaware Code?
No, to LLCs. It's pretty specific.
Yeah.
But that's the statute, and we don't have that here.
Well, there's two issues. The Delaware statute related to Section 606 is almost identical to the 606 that we have.
Right.
Very recently, the Supreme Court of Delaware has said, you have to treat these kinds of entities differently. You have to enforce the rules as they're written. They were looking there at an analogous situation where the question was, can you bring, as a creditor, a derivative action against the corporation, even though the only standing to bring a derivative action is lodged in the members under the LLC Act? And the Delaware Supreme Court has said, no, you don't have a right as a creditor. This is what the statute says. This is the protection that's afforded. When you deal with an LLC, you need to know your rights and you need to take steps to protect yourself. And the LLC Act allows you to do that by contract, as I was explaining before. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You may.
Morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Graham Fuller. I represent respondent Coldborn Foodbotics in this matter. This is a complicated case, but it really presents a straightforward and simple question. In Colorado, is there justification to treat creditors of an LLC any differently than we treat creditors of a corporation, specifically when it regards an unlawful distribution?
May I interrupt you 1 second?
Certainly.
Maybe the question could be even simpler to start with, and that is, since we're construing a statute, at least with regard to the first issue, how does one construe the words liable to a limited liability company to mean liable to its members?
Sure. Certainly. And our argument in that regard is that we have Colorado case law in the corporate context, which is the FICOR case. And in that case, the Supreme Court in 1982 determined that the phrase liable to the corporation in a substantially similar unlawful distribution provision extended a right of action to creditors in certain specific situations.
And I should have said creditors, but let me move on then to just ask you then. And we've sort of got two problems here. One, we've got a different statute, but before you even get to that, do you think FICOR was rightly decided?
I do think FICOR was rightly decided. If FICOR is not decided as it was, I believe that creates quite a loophole and would really thwart the efficacy of the purpose of that statute. And the FICOR court correctly noted that the purpose of the statute is for the protection of creditors.
Usually, before we get to looking at purposes, don't we need to determine whether the words at issue actually admit of more than one interpretation?
Definitely. And there are a few rules of statutory construction on that point, and one of them is certainly that the plain language of the statute should not be disrupted. And a caveat to that is unless it creates an unreasonable or an absurd result. And there are plenty of situations, and I think this is what guided the FICOR court, plenty of situations where corporations are they're closely held or they're small or they are they're just a few similarly related people in all of the capacities, as few as one sole officer, director, and shareholder.
May I interrupt you there about statutory construction just so that we narrow down on this? So you seem to be interpreting the absurd language to mean even if there is no ambiguity, if the statute is absurd, would be absurd construed as it must be, as the words only allow, nevertheless that allows us to decide those words do not control.
I guess my argument is that if the statute in a literal reading would result in an absurd result, that creates an ambiguity as to what the legislature intends.
And so with regard to the language in FICOR and also with this language, you're basing your statutory construction on the fact that the words as they appear would be absurd?
Yes, because there would be too many situations where I would say more situations than not where the statute's policy would not be given effect by a literal reading. The purpose of these statutes traditionally is to protect creditors. And the Colorado's legislature passed the LLC Act. We were the third state to do so pretty early on in that historical process. And in setting forth the Colorado Act, we did not go with the Uniform Act, which many other states have adopted, though certainly there are similarities. Colorado's LLC Act is a hybrid of its partnership code and its corporate code, and with various provisions taken from both and, of course, adapted for the LLC context.
Just if I can just ask you one last follow-up on this line of question. Am I correct, then, that where this argument leads for you is not simply that it would be reasonable for the legislature to have intended liability to creditors as well, but rather it would be absurd for the legislature not to have intended liability of the members to creditors?
I'm not sure I'd want to go that far, but to me, when the legislature acted in drafting the LLC Act, at that time FICOR had been decided and had given an interpretation to the phrase liable to the corporation, and specifically in the unlawful distribution realm. And our argument is that when they instituted the LLC Act, they did so with knowledge of that decision and understanding the interpretation it had been given and being comfortable with that.
Okay. I think I understand your position at this point. Let me stay with you for one more question,
sure,
and I'll stop dominating your time. Take it one step further then. The act that we construed in FICOR has changed. I know the Court of Appeals, at least in paratransit, seemed to indicate that the same reasoning should apply to the current act. That obviously is not binding on us. Why should we find that persuasive, even if we do find the interpretation from FICOR persuasive?
Certainly. And I think there's a couple of responses to that. First of all, you're correct that the Corporate Act has been modified a number of times since FICOR was decided. It was modified in 1993, effective 1994, and also amended in 2004, 2006, and 2007. And each time with regards to this specific area, which FICOR did decide, and FICOR, in my opinion, is a fairly narrow holding, is unchanged in each of these modifications. And I think that gives strength to our argument that the legislature understands FICOR, is comfortable with the result that gives and the narrow interpretation that it's given of the corporate statute, and has chosen to use the same language in the LLC statute.
Counsel, before you move on, can I just get you to directly address what your opposing counsel argued in terms of the nature of the LLC Act? I think she presented a narrative that we had all this corporation law, common law, and then the LLC comes along, and that's a new and different animal that the legislature came up with, right? Which I kind of hear you saying, but I'm wondering if you could react to that, because I think where that argument leads your opposing counsel is that there really isn't any common law of LLC. This is a new, brand new animal that starts essentially afresh or in a different direction, so it would be improper to imply our common law cases into the LLC. Can I get you to directly address that?
Certainly. The LLC, of course, is another type of limited liability, like a corporation. And of course, if you were to see an attorney and to discuss what type of limited liability entity you wish to form and the different reasons for different entities, there are going to be differences, certainly. It's been often stated that that the limited liability given by the LLC code should not be interpreted to extend liability further than it already exists in the corporate code. And that's exactly what my opponents would wish to have happen here, is to have a different outcome if the creditor is one of a corporation than one of an LLC. And you're right, there is very little common law on LLCs in Colorado at this point. We are at the forefront of that nationally, being one of the first states to have incorporated an LLC Act. But the policies specifically in regards to protecting creditors are the same between LLCs and corporations, that the investors in a business take the risk that the business might fail because of economic reasons, take the risk that the business might fail because they make poor business decisions. But these creditors, even contractual creditors, and this is not to even talk about purely unsecured tort creditors, for instance, there's nothing to believe that the legislature intended that the creditors take the risk that the owners and managers of an LLC might abscond with the money and leave nothing for creditors.
Mr. Fuller?
Yes.
Let's assume that for a second there is a duty. Sheffield is rightfully decided. Have you met pleading-wise? Have you shown that it's insolvent at the time the distribution was made?
I believe we have. We did specifically plead insolvency in the amended complaint. I think the bigger question is, have we pleaded the elements of the fiduciary duty? In Anstein, that is set out as basically the directors or officers of a corporation are not allowed to favor their own interests over the interests of a creditor, mm-hmm, in the zone of insolvency. The paratransit case actually expands that a little bit, citing Crowley and Rosebud, and says that the duty is actually threefold, even narrowed down to the creditor duty, and that is to not divest corporate property for personal gain, to not prefer themselves over creditors, and not to defeat creditors' claims. Even if it's just the narrow interpretation of a director or an officer should not favor their own interests over a creditor, I think that is adequately pleaded here. We've alleged that these distributions were made at a time when our debt was contingent but not vested. And so they were aware and on notice that there was potential liability there. We've also alleged that the structure of the LLC was such that the members were the same as the managers. And the way that breaks down basically is that we have the LLC, which was Boulder Partnership. The two members of the LLC were Ken Major and Michael Weinstein. The two managers of the LLC were two corporations, and the sole officer, director, and shareholder of each of those corporations was one of the two members. So while the managers weren't literally favoring themselves because they were corporations, at the end of the day, the left hand was shaking the right hand, and it was the same people involved in this decision.
Well, that brings up part of the issues that are raised by Ms. Potter, I think. One is the You're asking for a general rule that applies to all LLCs, right?
We are.
And here you have a situation where it's clearly a closely held LLC. Right?
Yes, and I don't think...
Let me finish.
Sure.
Then you can tell me. And the second is, what about the flexibility that's needed, which is really underlying, I think, the premise that Justice Hyde mentioned, which is this is a whole new animal. And sir, you mentioned it when you said we're making a kind of a fusion, if you will, between partnership law and corporation law, right, for an LLC. So how do we account for all these interests if we say there is a limited fiduciary duty?
I think your point was correct in questioning on petitioner's beginning portion of argument, which was that the flexibility and the freedom of contract that are provided in the LLC Act should not be able to take away rights from a third party. That's a tenet of contract law, is that a contract cannot bind a third party, it cannot take away or create any responsibilities or interests for a third party. And I think that the argument that the LLC provides greater flexibility, if anything, gives credence to the idea that an LLC is not intended to have any greater liability than a corporation. If anything, these people have incredible flexibility, and they have the benefit of pass-through taxation without having to go through the process of creating an S-corp. And that flexibility, if anything, lends itself to more easily defeating creditors' claims. And so for me, the flexibility argument doesn't hold up.
Could I keep you sort of on that point, but bring you away from policy back down a little bit more to specific statutory matters? With regard to the footnote in Onstein that we talked about, where we noticed the, 7108-401 sub 5 had been passed but didn't apply in Onstein, and we specifically didn't comment on what effect it would have with regard to insolvency. Answer the question that we left open then. After the passage of that statute, should we find that this limited fiduciary duty to creditors that we described in Onstein still applies, even with regard to corporations?
I believe it does. Just as a precursor, I don't think that the court has to reach that issue to decide our case, because the same language does not exist in the LLC code. That's solely an animal in the corporate code. But to answer your question, the language that was at issue in the footnote in Onstein is the statutory language, and I'm paraphrasing, is basically a director shall have no duty to a creditor arising solely out of their status as a creditor. And the legislature, when it does intend to abrogate a common law rule, has to speak clearly, and I don't think that satisfies that requirement. If they meant for directors of a corporation never to owe a duty to creditors, then the portion of the sentence solely arising out of their status of a creditor would be redundant. And of course, we have to assume that the legislature's words have meaning. I think their purpose in saying solely arising out of their status as a creditor is to say that there are other circumstances where that duty may arise, and may have even been a tip of the cap to Onstein to say when insolvency is at play, that may be one of those circumstances where we don't want the general rule that directors and officers typically do not owe duties to creditors. That may be a situation where we want that rule not to apply.
Could I ask just one other? Your introductory comment there about the difference between LLCs and corporations is interesting. So do I understand that then that you feel our rationale in Onstein applying this limited fiduciary duty of corporate shareholders, of corporations to creditors, should apply to LLCs, but the statute, corporate statute, doing away in some circumstances with that limited fiduciary duty should not translate to LLCs.
And that's, I think, an interesting point, because I think myself and opposing counsel have a bit of a struggle there, because we, on one hand, are arguing that the provisions of the two codes should be read together or not, And then with regards to specifically Anstein, we are saying that, well, in that specific respect, then they shouldn't apply. Again, my argument is that statute does not abrogate the common law claim. Is your question what should happen in the LLC realm if it does?
I guess my question was just with regard to the logic that we do translate the common law fiduciary duty from corporations to LLCs, but when that fiduciary duty is abrogated by statute for corporations, we shouldn't translate that abrogation to LLCs.
I think that if the legislature intended that to abrogate the common law and saw that it was going to be extended, I think they would probably act pretty quickly and try to come back on that. And they would probably pass a similar statute, but maybe a more clearly worded statute if that was what their intent was.
Okay, thank you.
Well, they always have the authority, you know, to react to our decisions, including the one we make in this case. So it seems to me that the issue comes down to what the legislative policy is with respect to trying to make this thread consistent about the duties owed to creditors. Are they fiduciary or not? Do we really have the protection for the officers and managers you would expect for people that are making substantial investments of their own? And these other remedies that counsel talked about actions that can be taken, suits can be brought if there is a kind of a fraudulent distribution. What about the answer, that answer? Why isn't that a credible answer that there are other alternatives for creditors?
I think there are other alternatives. In my opinion, when a statute is more specific, that should be the way that you proceed. To me, the unlawful distribution statute is very specific that these types of distributions are not allowed, and incorporating the reasoning in FICOR to the same language, it's our belief that that's the most specific cause of action to be brought. I think it's true that there are fraudulent conveyance and piercing the veil claims, mm-hmm. but obviously there are big struggles with bringing those claims as well. For instance, in our case, we didn't plead a piercing the veil case because we didn't think it was a viable claim. The piercing the veil is a 7-part test, and I think it's a totality of the circumstances test. On a pretty narrow reading of those 7 parts, I think we only meet one, which would be that the entity was left undercapitalized. Otherwise, it appears that the LLC was operating pursuant to LLC requirements and procedures. As far as fraudulent conveyance, there you have to prove intent to defraud, which of course is a much higher bar to meet than simply proving that a distribution occurred, it created a problem in that there was no money left for creditors, and to allow the creditor to bring that action just like they would be able to in the corporate setting.
Mr. Fuller, what about the fact that you haven't pled or certainly have pled at this stage anything about representing all the creditors or what the other creditors were?
So the FICOR holding is narrow to situations where there is one creditor, one unpaid creditor, or the suit is brought on behalf of all of the creditors. And to me, that's really a notice pleading and a leave to amend issue, and shouldn't be something that's being dealt with on a Rule 12 motion to dismiss. In FICOR and in Paratransit, those cases got all the way to trial and were up on appeal. We're dismissed before we even get to disclosures or discovery. And of course, the issue as to whether there are other creditors is something that's not really within my client's knowledge at the time the suit is originally brought. So certainly we'd feel that we would have the right, if we were to be sent back to the trial court, to make those certain discoveries and to bring the claim either as the sole creditor or on behalf of all creditors. There's a lot of good language that small procedural issues like that should not thwart a claim because they do nothing to advance the policy of protecting creditors, and they really don't serve a purpose in that regard. And so our argument would be that at this point, that's an unknown to us and should be something that's discoverable. If there are other creditors, they can be brought in once they're known, because the same transaction or occurrence that gave rise to the to our complaint is the same transaction or occurrence. It's the unlawful distribution.
Well, obviously you would have an adverse interest with other creditors, right?
Well, I think that's the purpose of the FICOR rule, would be to make sure that those competing interests, one doesn't get elevated over another. And I think that the discovery process would help bring that out. And I would say that the court could even order that the trial court conduct a hearing on that issue specifically to try and ferret that answer out quickly, if the court was concerned about that. I have only a few more minutes, so if the court doesn't have further questions, I will briefly conclude. My client has already proven liability of $250,000 in the underlying arbitration and is simply having an effort to have it stay in court and attempt to recover some portion of those funds. LLC laws are not intended to create broader limited liability than corporations already enjoy.
Mr. Fuller?
Yes.
Since you do have a couple of minutes, let me go back to the limited fiduciary duty and tell me how specifically you meet the pleadings requirements that were stated in Einstein. Or I should say Einstein. It's like Justice Coates pronounces
it. Okay. In Einstein, the
how do you? I know what Einstein did, but tell us what you did.
We claimed that the managers effectively favored their own interests by making a distribution from the two corporations that were solely run by the members of the LLC to the members of the LLC.
Well, there's nothing in there about defeating other creditors' term claims, right?
I'm sorry?
There's nothing in your complaint, your amended complaint, dealing with alleging that the purpose of the transfer is to defeat creditors' claims, is there?
I don't believe that we allege that the purpose of the transfer was to defeat the creditors' claims.
And isn't that part of the breach of fiduciary duty under Einstein?
I believe the language is to not defeat creditors' claims.
Right.
I don't know that there's a purposefulness requirement there, but that's certainly what's happened here. And I don't know if we specifically alleged that they intended to do this, but I think, you know, given the timing compared to the arbitration in Illinois.
Well, that's a pretty major point, isn't it? You're trying to go after the individual assets of these persons, right? Their family, their property, their home, who knows what it is.
Right. I think that the policies at play in the corporate context with regards to breach of fiduciary duty are very much at play in our context here. There was a distribution made from really the same people that the distribution went to, and that left no money to be accessible to creditors, and putting it into the area of insolvency. And
so there's no protection at all in this LLC Act, is there, for individuals? Under your theory and the way you pled it, you know, you get an arbitration award, you get to collect. I mean, isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think so. I think there's a lot of other facts at play that give rise to the personal liability in this case. The limited liability extends and assumes right doing by the LLC and by a corporation. I misspoke. Of course, by a corporation, since we're asking that this be extended in the LLC context. And if the arbitration award had come through, and if they had distributed all of these assets before there was ever a contingent liability there, I think there's a lot of different fact sets where there isn't personal liability.
Ms. Fuller? Can I just interrupt you? Because I'm doing a few minutes. I just reviewed. I'd forgotten. I should have looked at the complaint more carefully. It seems to me that both causes of action in the amended complaint deal with a statutory violation. So is it your position that a statutory violation, 606 violation, is sufficient to plead a common law?
The way that that was pleaded was basically to set out a section that dealt with cause of actions against managers,
right,
a section that dealt with cause of action against members.
Mm-hmm.
And so the
statutory claims, right, 606.
Yes, but the fiduciary duty claim is the common law claim, and that's
yeah,
how
but
that
I don't see that. You're asking us to surmise that
in the
under
in
notice pleadings, right?
What's that?
Am I missing something? I don't see it.
Are you on the amended complaint?
I think so.
I think it's under the same unlawful distribution section,
okay,
and I believe it's the final two paragraphs of that section that talk about the fact that these distributions rendered the LLC insolvent and that they breached their fiduciary duty by making the distributions.
I may have the wrong. There's two amended complaints?
I think there was just one amended complaint.
I don't see anything about the word fiduciary, but it's okay. Thank
you. I think just by way of analogy, to just make sure that the court understands exactly what sort of circumstances will be affected by this ruling, I think it'd be appropriate to think about a situation where there's a local mom and pop pizza restaurant and they send their delivery driver out and it hits somebody. And of course the pizza place is liable by principal and agency relationships. That person, let's say that the pizza place knows that they've done this and takes all the money out for themselves and leaves an empty shell of an entity. That unsecured creditor should not be treated differently if that pizza chain was an LLC or if it was a corporation. They should have the same rights because the legislature used the same language in both statutes. And I think by doing so intended that the creditors would have equal rights in both contexts. Thank you.
Mr. Fuller, before you step down, you're right. Paragraph 15 uses the word fiduciary.
Okay.
I stand corrected.
Well, that's a relief.
Thank you. Rebuttal, Ms. Potter?
Your Honors, counsel said something that is critical to understand here. They said we have big struggles in being able to bring incorporating the corporate veil claim. We have big struggles in bringing a fraudulent transfer act claim. There's a reason why that bar is set so high. There's a reason why you have to prove fraud. There's a reason why there's 10 elements in the piercing the corporate veil context in order to go behind that corporate fiction and to go against the personal assets of an individual. They're asking you to come up with an easier way for them to do that. And they're trying to create new causes of action that allow them to get around the difficulty that has long existed in piercing that corporate veil. They have not pled claims that they're claiming they have pled. On the issue of the 606 action, if you are going to make a determination that you're going to apply a rule like you did in FICOR here, FICOR was very clear that that occurs only in a limited circumstance, and that limited circumstance is one. It's a derivative claim brought in the name of the corporation. That's the only way you get through that corporate language to create a cause of action in the creditor. They did not bring this claim in the name of the creditor. Number two, you have to either allege or prove that you are acting on behalf of all creditors, or you have to prove that you're the only creditor that's unpaid at that time. They haven't even discussed other creditors. And number three, you have to state that you will not be preferentially treated over other creditors by bringing your claim. That allegation is nowhere to be found. Counsel wants to say, well, that's something to be left for a later date. That's something to be left for post-discovery. That's not true. First of all, counsel had the whole reason, and if you look in their complaint, They deposed my clients as a result of the judgment action in Illinois and had every opportunity to ask the questions they needed to ask to allege the complaint. Number two, the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure give you ways to plead claims involving unknown parties. Look at CRCP 9, I think it's A2 through 4. There's three or four rules right there that tell you how you plead a claim against a party that is unknown to you but that you suspect has an interest. They didn't do that here. They want to tell you, well, we're following this exact cause of action, except for we don't have to follow it. Well, they didn't follow it. They haven't pled that claim. And I don't believe they've adequately pled either the fiduciary duty claim. They have to explain how the managers of this corporation preferred their own interests over those of the creditors. The managers of these LLCs were corporate entities. Behind them stood the members. Behind them stood another layer. They haven't alleged how the managers gave preferential treatment here. They've alleged that the members of the LLC were given preferential treatment. They're conflating and asking you to just run through these differences about what is a member, what is a manager, who were they, how were they acting. If they really think that there was a fraud being worked here on how this company was set up, they should bring a piercing the corporate veil cause of action. But they can't. They don't have the facts for that. And that's why it hasn't been done. I also wanted to note, going back, Justice Bender, to your questions earlier about the fiduciary duty. There's one other provision that I want to point you to in the LLC Act. It's section 404.4. And it says that the members in a limited liability company are not responsible solely because they act in their own interest. That's something that we haven't heard about in the corporate context. I'm just about out of time. We ask that you affirm the trial court. Thank you very much for hearing this case today.
Thank you. I want to thank both parties for your arguments and the briefs, and note again the historical nature of this proceeding. The case will be submitted on the briefs, and the court will take a 10-minute recess.
Thank you.